This is Art Moves. Art Moves is a series of curated conversations at the intersection of art, innovation, and social justice.
Each week, we'll be talking with the innovative thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts or redefining what it means to be creative.
I'm Tony Williams.
And I'm Eli Kaslansky.
And we're your hosts for Art Moves. Today we'll be talking to the leading authority on audience development and community engagement, Donna Walker Kuhn from Walker Communications. Donna, so great to see you.
Thank you. You too, Tony. Yes. I love your innovation.
Oh, thank great. You so much. And if you could share what does Walker Communications do? Because I want our listeners to know exactly what you do and why it's so important.
Certainly. Well, we are a 30-year-old boutique marketing agency that focuses on audience development and community engagement. So we are often hired to bring in multicultural audiences. We also have developed a new division just this past year that focuses on diversity, equity, and inclusion training, as well as social justice programming.
Yeah, I can imagine you're pretty busy in that diversity, equity, inclusion space right
yes,
now.
Yes, we are.
Since art and culture is a real hotbed there.
Yes, it is.
So I'm going to pitch that first question, and it has to do with something that I saw on your blog, which is quite informative. I love your blog.
Thank you.
But it has to do with We See You, White America. Can you talk to us about what that movement is?
Yes. So after the murder of George Floyd, there was a movement from the black and brown community that supports Broadway, either on stage or behind stage, to really look at what are the demands we have for white American theater. It was a moment of reckoning that for so many years we have endured racism, discrimination, prejudice. And so they wrote a extensive document that has a number of committees that really said this is what we need in order to feel equity, inclusion on Broadway. This letter was released in the New York Times, and it has now had hundreds and hundreds of theater workers who have now signed on to support it. This letter is calling for very specific action steps. What does theater need to do in order to have an equitable environment? And there's been a significant response.
Now, I read the letter, and then I'm going to segue over to Eli, but I read the letter, and I read the demands. How powerful are black and brown people on Broadway?
At this moment?
Yeah.
I think we are emerging in our power. Prior to the murder of George Floyd, we were really just being hired to do productions. There are a few black producers on Broadway, but it was primarily, let's get them in, let's do the show. Very few in production, very few, in the pit, the music pit. Now, there's definitely been a moment of reckoning. I would say that there's an emerging power that if we keep our eye focused, you know, and are in the rooms where decisions are being made, such as with the Broadway League, the Schubert Foundation, the unions in particular, then we can actually start to see change and transformation. But at least there is a document. There has been discussions built around it. The Broadway League just hired for the first time a director of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Now, that's a major move. That means this person, this woman, is empowered to now provide oversight to all of the league members who are Broadway producers. And then you have, you know, the unions are having many discussions back and forth. How do we implement this? What does this mean? And so it's very much in the conversation stage, but it's the first step.
So it would be fair to say that a lot of your work centers around this anti-racist theater system. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Anti-racist theater?
Yes.
Yes. So what many actors and those behind the scenes commented on in the letter was the racism that they experienced as human beings, either being marginalized to a specific role, not being given a voice to be able to share what they think. And one instance I read about, one of the cast members from one of the musicals was told at intermission, you know, you sang that song like it was some soul song, and you know it's not. You know, why did you step outside of your lane? And so this constant and consistent marginalization, so many plays with black themes close after 3 or 4 months. So where's the investment? Where's the commitment to really make it a success? And so now all of that's being examined. There is a power base I see being developed. There's 7 black plays that are opening this season on Broadway. Never in the history of Broadway have we had 7, and certainly not at the same time, plus the already 3 existing black plays. So now you'll have 10. Now keep in mind, it's 3% of the audiences for Broadway are African American. So the expectation for deliverables is yet to be seen. You know, how many are actually going to come in the wake of this pandemic? You know, just how comfortable are people coming to sit inside of a theater side by side? So you've got all these multiple layers of how will this work? What does success look like? So we're all watching.
I'm real concerned about sustainability, you know. Meaning right now we're in a moment where people are listening. But what happens when that moment, I mean, how do we keep the momentum on without looking like we're just, you know, you don't want to look like you're getting on people's nerves, but we have to get on people's nerves. Do you know what I mean?
Do.
Meaning that's the piece. It's like, how much can you speak this truth? Are we going to have to just keep speaking it and speaking it and speaking it? Is that what you would suggest, Donna?
I think that definitely we have to insist on being in the room. We have to be demanding. This is no longer may I. This is what time is the meeting? I'll be there. That's
right.
Where we are. And there's a boldness and a bravery that I believe our African American and of color and allies are ready to have. You know, I see that being exhibited in various marketing meetings. There are probably 10 different of color support advocacy groups that evolved out of the, you know, White American Theater Letter. And so they are also, you know, really advancing these conversations. But you're absolutely right. Accountability, transparency will be the key to success.
So this is not just the front of the house where the actors and the performers are up, but it's also back of house too, right?
And
also
this is
administration and leadership.
Yes, leadership for sure. That's where the decisions are made. So it's the leadership, it is the crews, it is the unions, it is the marketing team. Marketing is a huge component of the success of a Broadway show. And my company has worked on 22 Broadway productions, and it was always focused on, you know, we want you to bring in the black community. So we always had to stay in our lane with an incredibly modest budget, embarrassingly modest, with the same expectations of that of white marketing. And so we always wondered about where's the equity there. So this is the time also where we have to build that into this formula.
My question, though, is so many things are driven by data, right? So there's 7 plays that are going to be of people of color.
Mm-hmm.
How do you ensure that white audiences, since it sounds like it's typically white audiences that make a play successful, how does that piece work?
So you have the traditional marketing strategies. You know, we still have the major ad agencies. You've got Spotco, a.k.a. I forget the other one. But there are 3 of them that pretty much command the marketing and advertising for Broadway. And then you have the publicists. So together, those two are going to make sure that the traditional theater goers are coming. What the challenge is that Broadway really exists on tourism. And that we don't really see coming in the same numbers that it has in the past. And so it may take another year before we actually see tourists coming in to support Broadway in the manner that it's accustomed to.
So one can actually think of this anti-racist theater system almost like a structure, right? And that it's something that needs to be built and also has to have pillars. So what would you describe the pillars are?
The pillars are the diversity, equity, inclusion. The bookends are transparency, accountability. The success will come from uprooting, disrupting white privilege.
Wow. That's a lot what you just said there.
Well, it's true.
Disrupting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she has to go.
How does she do that?
So that's this whole journey. That's this process of dialogue. You know, we talk about quiet revolutions. I believe the most important revolution is our human revolution, and that is each person taking full responsibility. How do I become a change agent so that theater is really an American experience? So the catalyst for the awakening of that comes through these continuous discussions that we're having with these various advocacy groups, with the writers who are now writing about this, articles that come out every day. And I believe that there are producers who are allies who really want to see change. And so it's the leadership there's not any one person that's leading this movement. It's a number of different entities. I think the stronger we can make the leadership, the more we'll see impact. So we're still in the embryonic stage. It's still just being birthed, I believe.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. We're talking with Donna Walker Kuhn, and this is a fascinating conversation, racial justice, Broadway, as well as some of the work that she's doing in the diversity, equity, and inclusion space.
You know, one of the things I think a lot of cultural organizations struggle with is relevancy. Mm-hmm. Even though they want certain audiences and certain mm-hmm. demographics, what they're showing and the way they're structured and the kind of presentations they do is not quite relevant for them. You know, and then it's interesting because we, you know, on my day job, if you will, we have an interactive multimedia firm. And it's one of the things we always ask is why? Why would people want to do that? Why would they be interested? Why is it important to them? Why does it matter in their life? Mm-hmm. So could you talk a little bit about, you know, because it's not just theater, it's also museums too.
Yes.
You know, how do these organizations make the work that they do more relevant for the communities that you work with?
So if the goal is to create work that resonates with Black and brown communities, then we have to have those stories. And not the same stories. New stories. Discovering new artists, new voices. It's limitless. Just think about the Black Panther effect. That movie, the success of that movie, new director, new stories, new writers, actors that we really weren't that familiar with, but the celebration of it, the lifting up of this is ours. So what happens is you have what Darren Walker talks about, you know, generosity versus justice. Darren Walker, the president of the Ford Foundation, and he is transitioning what the funding model looks like. So it's not just generosity. We're giving out of the goodness of our heart. We want to help lift up this underserved community. No, we're turning the page on that. We're talking about establishing justice. And so if we look at what's relevant is whose stories are missing and how are they being told? You know, is it from a marginalized perspective? You know, is it truth and honesty? Is it variety? So there's many different opportunities. It's linking yourself to the future and not just the past.
You know, it reminds me of something I read in a book called about the Vietnam War, because I went to Vietnam. The thing about it was JFK went there when he was a senator, and they put him on the tour, the official tour, and he got the tour. Then he decided to go off on his own. And he says something very interesting. He says that the problem isn't communism. It was like, you know, injustice and inequality and mm-hmm. poverty.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he changed his tune when he ran for president, but, you know.
Yeah, I think that truth, we know the truth, right? We know that. That's deeply embedded in our hearts. But now I'm going to talk about a question that we had spoken about, Eli, which is where is it that now what we're seeing is that people are shutting down the conversation on diversity,
oh, yeah,
equity,
with all
and
these
inclusion. They're shutting it down. So where are we? Meaning, I want to believe that we're making progress, but then you've got critical race theory deniers. How do you address that in your practice? Because you're in the diversity, equity, mm-hmm. and inclusion mm-hmm. and access space. How do you address those kinds of issues?
With patience and compassion that the person is so disconnected from reality. But I'm a firm believer in dialogue. And so I think we have to be incredibly persistent and demonstrate the facts. There's clear evidence on this. So it's not a question of what I feel. We look at the numbers. So how many people of color do we have participating? What does leadership look like? How many people of color are leading arts organizations, leading and producing? I remember Stephen Bird, one of the few Black producers on Broadway, saying how when he wanted to produce Cat on a Hot Tin Roof with an all-Black cast, it took him 10 years. Not because he didn't have the funding, he had plenty of money, but because the theater didn't want to give him a theater. Because it was like, well, what can he do with this? And so it goes back to white privilege and the whole idea that I own this and I'll decide if you're worthy of it, and I decided that you're not. And so we, meaning Black and brown communities, we have to be incredibly aggressive and dynamic in our conversations, but also align ourselves with allies. We can't be the only ones at the table. And so we have to make sure that we're engaging other power brokers who can speak on our behalf and speak for us so that collectively this energy is moving forward.
What do you deal with in a situation like a place like Texas, where unreasonably, they're so fearful about this conversation about white privilege and racism that they're actually criminalizing the discussion of it in schools.
Well,
they don't care about facts.
I understand. We had a former president that tried to do that as well, that wanted to remove all funding for any federal agency that was doing the DEI training. But that was not successful, that effort. And so in a place like Texas, I believe we'll see change one by one. Not everyone is going to subscribe to that and shut it down. And so while it may not be on a grand scale, it'll certainly be happening within the arts sector. They're going to find a way to be able to do this and still have these conversations. I believe the success we will see based on the transformation of audiences, how the arts organizations are growing and thriving. And there has to be a kind of determination and persistence that is unbeatable. You know, the posture has to be, I'm immovable. So this is like the civil rights movement. You know, we were willing to do whatever it took to be heard and to get those kind of results. And this is the same movement. This is another genre, but the same movement.
You know, Eli mentioned Texas, but we got Texas right here in Brooklyn, meaning progressive liberals oftentimes feel that how can they be racist?
Yes.
But this is something that's embedded in the way we think and feel because it's been layered in this country for so long.
Yeah.
How do you approach that crowd?
So in some of my workshops, I have responses from, particularly when I'm working with board of directors. And
that's where I was
and
going.
And one gentleman said to me, he said, quote, little lady, are you saying to me that I'm a racist? And I said, what part of that word is indistinguishable to you? What part of that word do you not understand?
He called you little lady?
Well, that part, I got that part.
But
it was the racism
right,
part.
Yeah.
That's the part piece that he was dealing with. And so I explained to him, just as you said, Tony, how racism is so deeply embedded in American culture. You know, from the time you're born, you're exposed to that in TV commercials. You're exposed to that in the dynamics of what looks like success in America, geography, where people live. My daughter, her summer job, she's working at Home Depot. And there was a white gentleman there with his son, and the little boy came over to my daughter and just wanted to say hi. And the father said, oh, we don't talk to those people. And that was last week.
And where is this?
This was in Edison, New Jersey.
Edison, New Jersey.
That's where she works. So to your point, absolutely, racism is alive and thriving in America. But for the first time in my lifetime, been here for a moment, I really believe that there is this awakening and reckoning that's coming from so many different power bases that, yes, there'll always be those dissenters, absolutely. But I hope that there'll be more who are advancing this. And so that, you know, will diminish the power that they think they may have.
You know, it's interesting in some ways. I think in some ways it's hard to distinguish because it's almost like ambient radiation. You know what I mean? It's part of the landscape to a certain extent. But I think the other dynamic with that, and I'd be interested to hear you talk a little bit about this, is they have a generation shift too.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a generation of digital natives, if you will, who don't want to wait for change.
Yes. Those wonderful millennials, is that what you're referring to?
No, it's a generation
after. Some of them are in that too, though.
Generation Z, generation that the true digital natives, because they, unlike the millennials, they grew up in a world that was totally where digital was ubiquitous.
That's right. That's right.
So actually, But interesting how you talk about your thoughts about, you know, what you think.
You know, I'm around that generation a lot. I think you're thinking about the teens. You know, my daughter's a teenager and her friends are over quite a bit. I think they're incredibly racially aware. I think how they are dealing with it might be different, certainly for my generation of the civil rights movement. But they're very aware of that and want to see change. They are, you know, looking at what are the opportunities for transformation? What kind of conversations do we have? They still are angry. They're angry. And so I think we have to guide them. I think that's part of our responsibility.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. We're talking to Donald Walker Kuhn about diversity, equity, and inclusion and race structures. And I have to say that I think boards is where this is all really needs to start, because I cannot tell you how charged the word white supremacist is. Meaning the minute you say white supremacist, people turn you off. because they feel it's the KKK.
That's right.
You know, or they feel it's the Nazis or something.
That's right.
But guess what? It's not. So how do we take – what kind of language can be created so that we can have the conversation?
I have a suggestion. I don't believe we have to dilute the language, and I refuse to do that. So I use white supremacy. I talk about white privilege. I talk about reparations. That's when you really see a reaction. You say the word reparations around a lot of white people, and they start thinking, well, what are you going to take from me? What? What do you mean? Reparations are about creating equity from what has been taken from various communities, not just African Americans. And so, you know, I believe that educating, dialogue, you know, continuously self-training, all of those are the components that will hopefully start to transform this thinking. But you're absolutely right. The board of directors, that's where the leadership is. That's where the fundraising is. That is where we can change. So I try to focus my
efforts. And that's where it's really embedded.
Yes, it is.
It's embedded there,
yes,
you know, because there's an obliviousness to it.
Yes.
And this thing takes so many different shades.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just black. It's not a black, white, black, brown thing. It can be these power dynamics can be coming from all over the place. I mean, it's
right.
Very complex.
Unconscious bias. It has
completely
to do with gender,
yeah.
Gender-based, lifestyle, LGBTQ.
Mm-hmm. There's another aspect of it that I'm listening to you. I was thinking about there's this idea about do you come from scarcity or abundance. And the
right.
Funny thing about it is that it's almost like they're assuming because if there's equity, you know, that there's going to be scarcity. But actually, it's the opposite because then it becomes more of a contribution. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
But do people believe that?
No, they don't.
No, they don't. And I would say that
especially
probably
when you have a media group that, you know, a portion of the media that's really promoting mm-hmm. this idea, and they're fearful because, you know, the time is not on their side.
Right.
You know, demographics are 2050. You know, won't be the majority anymore.
That's right. Well, it's actually on the Northeast Corridor. They're no longer. That's why the word minority is such a misnomer if you're describing black and brown communities.
Especially in Brooklyn. Big misnomer.
No,
yeah,
my favorite.
Well, I don't accept the word. If I hear it in my presence, I correct immediately.
It's old language, and unfortunately, I'm old.
You know,
I've been around a while. But, you know, you mentioned reparations. And one of my friends said something so interesting. They said, well, Mackenzie Scott provided our cultural group with some reparations. And I said, in a way, that was true. You know, she's been such a giver and really helping to move the dial in the sustainability of art and cultural organizations.
Yes,
can you
is.
Comment on that?
Absolutely. I am very, very pleased with her philanthropy and the model that she's creating for funding. I am hoping that other funders will look at this. One, no application. We do our research. We know who has the capacity to utilize these funds in a smart way. I think the fact that she's focusing on looking at organizations that have not been receiving significant funding, a few thousand dollars, that's lovely. But when you get $5-10 million, then you can start to build. And so I think it's absolutely fantastic.
Right.
And Darren Walker has done similarly. You know,
well,
he created a program called, you know, Americans Cultural Treasures. And so that initiative is doing the same thing. He said, I refuse to see organizations of color suffer because of COVID. So I'm setting up this whole initiative. And he brought Elizabeth with him from, you know, Mellon. He's bringing the Duke. So he's bringing in major funding. So I'm seeing a trend in funding of making a significant transition to look at who has been marginalized and who has not been the recipient of major funding. So and you have the Black Seed as well. You know, which is addressing African-American theaters led by African-Americans who are producing African-American plays.
And there's about $7 million, I believe, in that particular fund.
Exactly.
I know that fund very well.
I'm
so
sure
thank
you
for mentioning the Black
Sea. Absolutely.
So I imagine you've also run up against a fair amount of resistance. So the organizations you work with, how willing they are to or open are to change and willing for them to be accountable?
Well, because they asked me, they've invited me to work with them. There's someone there who is open to change. So usually I get the invitations from the executive director or a board member, and they will say, we need to do this work. How can you help us? And so whether or not everyone on board wants to commit to this, there's a majority that says, yes, this is our direction. I am uncompromising in my work and my strategy and what I say. I'm very transparent. So if you want me to do this, this is what we're going to say. And I'm on the mild side. Some of my other colleagues, they come in with guns. So I have decided, you know, I believe in soft power. I believe that, you know,
soft power.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Soft power, meaning to enable the person that I'm talking to, the listener, to believe it's their idea. To create a spontaneity where they'll say, oh, that's great, let's try this, as opposed to hard power telling people what they must do. Mm-hmm. You know, I think people turn off from that.
Absolutely. What do you do when the folks that are perpetuating racist structures are people of color and African Americans, or you know, that happens too.
Yes, it does.
And also
we have
gatekeepers.
And also people in position of power too. Mm-hmm.
We have discrimination within our own community, and we have colorism within our own community. You have to look a certain way.
So one is what you're talking about, in some ways sussing out who the ones who are people who you can imagine being allies, if you will, or. So part of that's intuitive, though. It's not just, you know, just listening. Part of it is just, in some ways, in the first 15 seconds, you would sort of get like, oh, this person's going to be a problem. This person's mm-hmm. going to be an ally. Is that something that you use in your work when you?
Yes. The challenge is then, for me, just personally, you know, encourage me to go deeper, you know, to establish more of a one-on-one relationship with them. But it's back to leadership. If you have the ED, the AD, chairman of the board, that gets it and is saying, let's do this, everyone else either has to follow or be quiet.
So what about a situation where you have the executive director being on board but not the person who's the chairman of the board? Because we see this situation a lot, actually.
Right, well, they're not on
the same
page.
Well, they're either cross-purposes or they're even in some cases where the chairman of the board is actually disrespectful to the executive director.
Yes. I'm aware of those scenarios as well.
Those are bad scenarios, and they happen all too often in our culture.
Because we know personally two organizations that have the same exact problem.
That's true, and we have to protect them. So, again, back to that ED, surrounding themselves with allies. Okay, I need you to come in the room with me. We have to – everything is a collective, you know, so I don't think any one person can stand out and change the world. But I know that with a movement, with data – you know, sometimes you have to find out what do people listen to that translates results to them. So you come in with the numbers. You talk about budget. You talk about impact. You have to think about what is my best tool.
You know, we're coming to the close of our show, and you sound really hopeful. And I'm happy that you're hopeful. And I'm hopeful, but I always need a little shot in the arm. So why are you hopeful? What makes you positive around this?
This is a great question. It's a choice. It's my choice. That's my choice. Mm-hmm. Yes. I see the world through the lens of hope and joy. Mm-hmm. That's my choice. And so because of that as my foundation, I'm absolutely able to advance knowing that my best efforts are going to produce a positive result.
I think it's also, too, about courage.
Yes.
You know, because these are some tough conversations,
yes,
and
they
I
are.
Found myself during this pandemic
mm-hmm.
in tough conversations,
yes.
but I keep
yes.
it frank.
That's right.
I keep it compassionate, but at the end of the day, it's a lot of work for us people of color right now.
It yes.
But it's work that must be done for my children and my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren. That's what inspires me with
me
this.
Me too. Legacy.
It's also coming from a declaration, you know, that you have a declaration of who you say you are and what mm-hmm. you say you're about.
Absolutely.
And it's the power of the word to a large extent.
Absolutely. Right. It's changing hearts and minds. And Donna, mm-hmm. this has been excellent. I'm feeling good. You brought that energy of joy. Thank you so much. It's so wonderful to host you on Art Moves.
Yes, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Art Moves is co-produced by Brick Arts Media and pre-recorded at Brick Studio in downtown Brooklyn.
This has been Art Moves with your hosts, Tony Williams and Eli Kozlansky. Find some art that moves you and share it with someone.